And the reason they called me mother is because these were college guys who, in a sense, were in reserves and knew they probably wouldn't go to Vietnam, thought the Army was Mickey Mouse, and yet they were, the next platoons were high school guys that were going to get their butt shot off. And I was the one that had to get them up at 3:30 in the morning, and I was the one that had to get them to mop the floor and so on, and I would get in there with them. It wasn't a matter of me just giving orders. But they just didn't want to do it. So, yes, mother, all right, mother, we'll do it, mother, you know, and just it got worse and worse and worse, abuse as things went on. So I can remember, you know, Baba just giving us, you know, crazy things about a candy bar that was found, and we had a full military funeral, and Taps was played, and this guy had to bury it 6 feet down, and somebody in the back was sobbing. I knew his brother Hershey, you know, and just crazy. Anything we could do, you know, to keep alive in this environment. So I knew that the Army had a reputation as drill sergeants for ridiculing pictures of your girlfriend or of your wife. So I didn't even take a picture of my wife. But I did take a picture of Baba, and it's the one above his chair in Mondalee Hall. And I rolled it up in a shaving case, a styptic pencil case. And so whenever I would get depressed, I would take it out and look at Baba. And of course, no one ever found it, because they probably would have poked fun at this Indian or grandfather-looking person, you know, in India, a sadra sitting in a chair. And I still have it. It's cracked, and you can hardly see it, but it's Baba. And it helped me a lot, and I still carry it with me on trips. So Baba gave me a lot of strength through it. And so right at the end, this has relevance, I guess, to me more than anyone else. We had the final tests, and I knew if we had 500 points, our drill instructors would serve us breakfast in bed. And I maxed this low crawl. I got 100, and there was agility. Got 100, and then there were these overhead monkey bars. It was another event. And then this overhead bars, and I'd never take my wedding ring off. And I remember it used to cut into me really bad. But I did several of these times back and forth, and I said, you know, have I done enough? He said, shut up, trainee. I'll tell you when you've done enough. And so finally he said, okay. And I dropped, and I had no strength, and my ankle crumpled underneath me. I had 10 minutes to recover before the mile run, and I had to basically run it with a sprained ankle. And it was throbbing and everything, and I laced it up as tight as I could so it wouldn't swell too much, and it was just numb. And I gutted it out and ran it in 6:11 with the boots and the stuff on. And I missed it by 3 points. 6 points was 100. So I got 497 and didn't get breakfast in bed, which is Baba's joke. And I knew somebody that did, though, and they loved it. And all these other things happened in the swamps and you know, all this training in the snow and just thinking, Baba, what is this war? What is all of this about? And then at the end, I maxed the tactical and the mental tests and was one of 6 candidates before an officer review board, including a Marine who switched branches. And a second lieutenant tutored me because he wanted our company to get it and taught me how to sit in a chair like this at attention. If they told me to relax, I was still supposed to have my palms on my thighs and not relax, and had me memorize the soldier's code of honor. And they asked me if I could say it, and they were shocked when I said that I could say it. And they said, all right, what's the 6th article? And that was the last paragraph, which is something to the effect that I'll never forget that I'm an American fighting man dedicated to the principles that made our country free, something like that. And so I left the room, and they gave me this honor as top soldier of the cycle, which, because of meningitis, we had 2 0 weeks. So after 2 weeks, we were still on 0. Can you imagine? So we had 10 weeks. So I was the top soldier out of 6,000 men. And so I got to review the troops with this general and somebody from AIT and 2 people from 2 specialized schools. So I went back to the barracks feeling, you know, pretty good about this, and then went to climb in the bed, and my bed had been thrown outside and filled full of shaving cream by these guys as their last little prank for mother the night before, and I had to sleep in this whole mess. And of course, that really made them mad when they found out I got this award. And my company commander was very glad, though, because our overall scores weren't so good, and he said at least that helped. And then had a chance to see my wife for a day and a half, and knew I probably wouldn't want to go back to the Army, and so I didn't, which I'm sure was very hard on her. And I forgot one other test. I got a phone call about halfway through from my Auntie Boo, because Mother knew it would be very terrible for me to bear, saying that Margaret had what I guess, could be called a seizure in the night. I think probably because of stress with her mother and me being gone and everything else. She never had one since. But they put her in the hospital, and we didn't know what it was, and they gave her medication. So on top of that, my wife was sick. So I had honors training there and did very well at Fort Sam Houston and came home and then decided to switch fields because I wanted to serve Baba by teaching, and UNC Chapel Hill let me take undergraduate anatomy and physiology courses and graduate courses at the same time and serve as an assistant soccer coach and teach three PE classes and give me some money for doing it. And then Margaret was willing to be a secretary, and she didn't really like college. It dropped out after 2 years and has since finished. But we lived in married student housing and was able to do pretty well there, and went on, decided to serve Baba on the university level, and felt I would be bored as a coach on the high school level. And my master's program fitted very well into a PhD program in what they call educational foundations, philosophy, sociology, and psychology. And I taught in the School of Education after that, and was the youngest PhD candidate they had at 25. Well, here came another test. Along came this test where I developed very bad dizzy spells, and they didn't know what it was. I turned my head, and I would just vomit for hours at a time. It turned out it was Meniere's disease, very common among older people, but also active people. Ringing in the ear, I lost half my hearing, and these terrible episodes of nystagmus where your eyes would just go back and forth like this, and I would throw up for just days at a time. Normally, they try vasodilators, diuretics, low sodium, vitamins. They tried everything under the sun, and nothing helped. So I had to quit school for 6 months. Finally, my surgeons flew with me on an airplane to Vanderbilt to a guy who had been trained by Bill House in Los Angeles, and only two people could do this operation. And they took out my mastoid bone and put a tiny Teflon tube with microsurgery under a microscope to relieve this excess fluid in my inner ear. And they still don't know what caused it, either a virus or whatever, but stress would trigger these attacks. And all I can say is, if you've ever been seasick, have you, or carsick? Okay, it's just 10 times that, where you just had to lie still, and I'd watch TV and get dizzy. And you just want to die, and yet you're not dying. You know, it's just vertigo, but you want to die. And I would just lie there, and Margaret had to, by that time, she was pregnant 8 months and had to keep everything quiet, you know, around the house. And she was kind enough to fly with me in her eighth month, and I had this operation. And this relates to my story with Baba, because I hadn't seen him, but I promised him in that bed in Vanderbilt that if I came through this operation, and it was somewhat risky because the brain was involved in a sense, because you were near the brain, but I wasn't that afraid of dying, but it was risky. But basically, I wanted it to work. I said, Baba, if I come through this operation, okay, and I'm athletic again, I'm not going to get caught up in school again like I did. You know, I'm not, because I had a reputation for working hard and getting honors grades, and my major professor said, John, you're great, but don't burn out. I'm afraid you're going to burn out. So everything was okay, except I had incisional pain, and the doctor was gone, and the nurse didn't recognize it, and I had terrible pain. They wouldn't give me any drugs because they were afraid. I just wanted drugs, and I've never taken any drugs in my life, including marijuana, except medication, but they thought that I wanted something like that because I kept asking for it a day or two after I shouldn't have needed anything. I got home, and it turned out I had an awful lot, a huge syringe this big of blood underneath this muscle they'd taken out of my jaw. It was hidden under the muscle, so they couldn't find the swelling. And at night, it made me feel like my head was coming off. And Baba put me through all that, you know, for a reason. And that's when I really, you know, became even closer. Because when you're so helpless, things are great. You don't need him as much, you know. And I just literally was on my knees, you know, just crying out through these attacks. And then the operation. So he turned the key, and I wanted to be near the center at USC Coastal. And the job fell through because of budget. But he gave me a very good job in the Shenandoah Valley. And by that time, I had a beautiful son named David, and I was there for delivery. And I was able to stay home and cook for 6 months, and Margaret had a hard time in delivery, and I was there with her, and so Baba gave me a lot through David, and basically just tried to prove myself at James Madison University after going to UNC Chapel Hill, and 2 years later, wouldn't you know it, back in the hospital throwing up for a whole week this time. And it was in the middle of a meeting. They took me out by ambulance, and the exams triggered it. And I was okay, went into remission. The next year, exam time, 2 weeks. And all I can say is, it's, you know, this terrible vomiting. I'd go in a wheelchair with this tremendous basin, and it was just crazy. You know, it would take several hours for them to control it. And the only drug that worked was a drug called Vontrol, and they had it on the bus from Stanton, and the bus driver dropped it, and the bus ran over it. And that's all that they had. So I had to wait vomiting for like another 16 hours until they got some from Charlottesville. And so, in a way, it wasn't a life or death illness, but it was this thing, you know, that I had to keep going through. And it was like an alarm clock. Bible, I always have ringing in my ears, and from a few nerve cells that were destroyed there, and I always will. But when I would have these attacks, the sound would change. And it was almost as if Baba literally has given me an alarm clock. So I should be grateful for that, I guess. So that did it. I really decided, you know, I wasn't gonna push it. But I kept getting sick, and they gave me a lot of different kinds of medication. I had three different kinds that I had to take. So I'd be flat on my back, and then I would go and ski, because I had learned how to ski. I'd go vomit, come back, go skiing, and it made my ex-wife, now we're divorced, very upset, because she'd nursed me and then I'd go skiing. You know, she didn't understand that. And by that time, partly because of my doctoral training and the job I had, now being committed to sports and her becoming very overweight when I got back from the Army, she just didn't like activity, didn't like to read books. And basically, we just outgrew each other. We became very different. And she didn't have a career. That was frustrating. I was frustrated being in a very small house with a child and all this pressure of the disease and having to lie quietly. And she was very understanding, trying to keep David quiet. But I just literally was not happy in that marriage, even though I felt close to her as a friend. I just literally had to get out of that situation, had to get out. And she knew that. And she had felt unhappy for a long time. So basically, it was a friendly breakup. We just dissolved everything in half, and that's the way it happened. But that was a terrible test for me, because I had no idea what a divorce really would be like with a child. And no one knows what you suffer in a bachelor apartment when your son is a few blocks away, the loneliness that you suffer, as she has suffered being alone, but is now married a few days ago again, so I'm happy for her, to an older man, which probably is a very good relationship. Yes, I managed to stay in the same town, and she wanted to stay and didn't want to leave. She had a connection with the university. Her mother had died. That brought us closer together of cancer, and really had nowhere else to go. So I've been able to see my son twice a week and feel through him that he loves Meher Baba very much. And that's a whole nother story about how much he has taught me. As Baba said, we have to be children. And through David's love at the center, I have become very close to Baba through him also, and in his innocent ways as a father. He has brought me. So I know I had to be a father. And Baba made me feel better in that quote of, you know, you cry because of your wife or your children. You've had numberless wives and numberless children. And I believe we had some counseling that I gave it my best shot. I was married for 9 years, and it just, my illness was better after the divorce. All this, you know, got a lot better. I'm very lucky, and we have a month. He spends the night with me, and we have a month together at the center, as I said, as part of the visitation. And we made arrangements to try, in the agreement, to stay within three states of each other as we could, if we could, because I grew up in a split situation where I only saw my father on vacations, which was very difficult. Came very close even to living with my father in junior high school, because I wanted that relationship. So Baba, you know, gave me all those tests. And as far as physical karma, I guess the other thing that happened to me about 3.5-4 years ago, I started having, I guess it was really longer than that, David, when I think about it. It started before we decided to separate. I started having spells, and I don't want to go into a long thing about it, but just to say that it was 5 seconds or so of confusion, and I started having 15 or 20 of these, and I didn't know what it was. They knew it wasn't my ear disease, and nobody could find out. I suffered with that probably for 1.5 years, something like that. And it got to the point where I had to try and have something done about it. I had tests made, and my ENT person, the ear specialist, said, well, let's just try this drug and see. Nothing else works. I don't think it's in your Meniere's disease. That seems to have gone in remission. It's not vertigo. And he gave me a drug which is used for seizures, which took care of it. And then he referred me to a neurologist. I had several EEGs. I've had a sort of a brief episode they're calling a temporal lobe episode during the test, which is supposed to be conclusive. They found nothing. The CAT scan is negative, so I don't have a tumor. So apparently this is my karma, and that Baba probably has lifted some of this. Probably would have been a lot worse. So I was given the medication, and all they can come up with is that probably scar tissue from this accident has worked its way down on the temporal lobe and is irritating it, because I had some tingling on my right arm and hand sometimes, which would make sense since it's on the left side. And I take my medication faithfully, and Margaret took the same medication for 7 years, and then they took her off of it after childbirth. So many people take it for various brain problems, and I'm sure that there's a reason for it, and I find that if I get enough sleep and I don't push myself, that things are fine. I'm a downhill ski racer. I came in fifth in 3 states last year. I surf and ski and all that. So I've had a series of physical problems, like my sister Diane, that have brought me very close to Baba, and that can basically be summed up, I guess, in a couple sentences. John's had a lot of physical problems that have brought him to the point where he realizes that, you know, we are helpless, basically. And it's when we cry out to him in that helplessness that he comes. And if we remember that during the good times, I think that the relationship becomes even stronger. And I've tried to do that. And I am very grateful to my health because of that. So that was basically the experience because of the Army and not getting to see him. Since the time that he dropped his body and going through the divorce, as I said, I have thought back on those close moments that Baba gave me, and I got on with the real work, I guess the Mandali would say, of finding Meher Baba in my heart and not in the form. And that's why I think I probably didn't come to India sooner than I did. It took me 15 years to come back. And I had graduate school, I had a child, and I was trying to find Baba in my heart, and I didn't want to worry about going to a tomb and worrying about his remains and so on. And of course, the center was a very different experience for me. Going in Baba's bedroom and lagoon cabin, in a sense, gave me that experience that other people hadn't had at Myrtle Beach. So I felt in Chapel Hill, in Virginia, I could go always on vacations and have this experience that was available. So I'm very grateful for the center. If I didn't have that, I'm sure I would have been to India many times. And the beautiful example of Auntie Boo and Kitty and Margaret Krask, who really are, you know, Mandali. They are his disciples in the West and have that relationship. A couple other things that might be interesting as far as direct correspondence. In the summer of 64, I finished high school, and again, I have these notes on a card, but enjoying the eye contact with you, I'm not really reading this in sequence. I was going to be employed at Crater Lake National Park as a person cutting bush, and got the job through a congressman my father was in the war with from Texas. Turned out I wasn't 18 and didn't get the job, and I was crushed, and he said, tell you what, my secretary got married, why don't you come and live with my family and do what she does. Show constituents around the Capitol, answer phones, do filing, write letters. And I said, are you kidding? He said, no. I said, I have, you know, several kids. Two of them are boys. We ride horses. You'll have a good time. And I said, okay. So I lived with them, and they were across the street from Mount Vernon, and I helped give tours there. And every day I went in with the congressman and learned quite a lot about Washington and realized that not all politicians were crooks, and had a chance through this congressman to have some unique experiences. For example, being alone with him and Cyrus Vance when they initiated the wheat deals with the Russians, because he was chairman of the subcommittee on agriculture. So it was a lot of excitement. And then in the afternoons, it turned out that Ivan Sinclair, special assistant to the president, needed someone to help with another young volunteer. read political mail to the president. Can you imagine? That was my job. That was non-priority mail. We had a huge code book that was labeled, the president has asked me to thank you for your A poem, B song, C slogan, D other, and I'd send it down with the code to the typing pool on White House stationery, and then Ivan Sinclair would sign it for the president. And some man sent his most prized possession to LBJ for the election of him kissing a grizzly bear in 1942, and some woman had this song to LBJ. These crazy things, you know, to the president. We're sitting around reading these letters, and it was a lot of fun. Well, I had an executive security clearance to get in the EOB right next to the White House, and that was sort of fun to go into the White House. But again, you know, as I said, didn't have much of a social life, and finishing high school there I was in Washington, and sort of complaining, and so this family said, tell you what, we'll fix you up with Lucy Baines, his younger daughter. I said, come on, she's not going to be interested in me. And they said, oh, no, she's just a down-to-earth Texas girl, which I found out she was. But Linda Bird was really into her father being president. Lucy really resented the lack of privacy, the change in her life, and so on. So they had her out to the house, and I still have photos of this birthday party. It was her birthday. And we hit it off and became very good friends. And she was 18, and I was only 16. So it was pretty much a platonic relationship as far as a boy-girl kind of dating kind of thing. But we spent a lot of time dating. But as far as romance, she was interested in guys 21 in a very naive way, believed that they were doing her a favor, you know, by asking her out for a date, irrespective of the fact she was the president's daughter. I remember one fellow, Paul Betts, had this little book she used to talk about with all the phone numbers, and he would call her, you see. But for us, it was just a pal kind of relationship. So every afternoon after work, we would go over to the White House, the volunteers, Beth Jenkins' daughter, her father was Walter Jenkins, Beth and Califano's daughter, and Bill Moyers and so on. We would sit around on the second floor, and she had converted the White House solarium into a bar. We'd drink beer up there in the White House on the second floor and, you know, not get bombed, but have a little beer or have a little Coke and refreshments. And Lady Bird would be down at the end of the hall. This is every afternoon, was down at the end of the hall with Liz Carpenter. I remember planning a trip to New Orleans, and LBJ would walk by, but I never really got to talk to them, but we were in the quarters, basically. And I got to call Lucy basically whenever I wanted to set up a date, and I still remember for the archives, it's 4561414. Got that, David? That's the official White House number for all time at that time. And I was on the list and could drive in and get through. And she had a new Corvette, BR Racing Green. And this is funny in light of Mani's comment from India. It's sort of funny. I wonder what Baba really was doing with me. We'd ride around town in her Corvette with the Secret Service following. And she loved go-go. It wasn't disco at that time. It was go-go. And we'd go dancing sometimes, a few times, but basically out to lunch and dinner. A place called Gusty's she liked a lot, and Knife and Fork, and the agent would sit right across from us all the time. So the best parties were at the White House upstairs because the agents weren't there. And I remember one of her maids teasing her because of this red dress with fringe and said, oh, Miss Lucy, your daddy isn't going to approve of that. She said, hush up, Louisa, whatever. I'm going to wear it anyway. And Lucy was just a fun kid. And so we had all these times together. And she loved to make the agents happy. They liked Redskin football. And she hated it, but she'd go to the games so the agents would get to go. And, you know, there were other things that happened with this congressman getting to sit in on a lot of congressional hearings. I took people through the Capitol, as I said, and lobbyists would take us out to dinner. So I really had an inside view of Washington. Yes, definitely. And she knew all about Baba in India, but I never really pushed it, but she knew about it. And, of course, she, you know, got to know me as a friend. So I waited until I had a relationship to talk about it. I didn't, you know, right away start talking about it. Because, you know, Lucy had other friends too, but by the end of the summer, we were pretty close. So I also got to go with this family down to Texas. My father was also in the war with a fellow named Speedy Hicks, whose wife was Governor Connally's sister, and he was champion calf roper at Texas A&M. So I got to ride down in Bandura, went by the LBJ Ranch and spent some time down there. And then after some weeks, I think it was 2.5 weeks in Texas, got to go to the Democratic National Convention. And my job, which is interesting in terms of Baba, maybe was working through me. I guess that's egotistical to say. But my job at this convention where LBJ was reelected in 64 was to coordinate floor communications. I had 12 Army field phones with 11 volunteers, with Moyers and Califano and Ivan Sinclair and all these, Walter Jenkins. There were 12 key people that the president had to be in touch with at all times. And so that was our job on the madhouse floor to do that. And got to go to his birthday party with Lucy. And as I said, she had a date there. It was funny. There were like two guys. We were sort of dating her at the same time at the birthday party. And that was the last that I saw of her. And I talked to her by phone the next year. And I went from sort of riches to rags because I worked on a surveying crew and cut trees out in the bushes of North Carolina. And then the family invited me back to live with them the next summer, and I ended up getting a job at Fort Belvoir cutting trees with the Army, because this other job wasn't available, and that was sort of a freak thing that I got to fill in for the secretary. But by this time, got to see Lucy again. She'd become a very different person, which is very interesting. Lucy was her own personality, as I said, very independent, and she got very interested in Catholicism and decided to become a Catholic, you know, much to the, I won't say consternation, but much to the surprise of Lady Bird and everybody else. You know, here's Lucy deciding to become a Catholic. And she got serious about it and studied the catechisms and everything. So instead of us going to a go-go joint in Georgetown, she would have the head usher, who'd been there for years and years, and I don't remember his first name, but she'd run to him and have him get on the phone, and they would call all over Washington to find where the last Mass was going to be held. And we'd jump in the car. She didn't have a Corvette anymore. Jump in the sedan with the agents, and we would go to Mass. And I went several times with her, and she really was serious. You know, I could tell she was really feeling this religious. She had the black thing over her head and so on. And we would go shopping for makeup, you know, this and that, and she had to go in disguise because people knew her by that time. She'd wear dark glasses and so on. So it was very interesting to me to see basically what was a total transformation in her life. And she got married very young to this other fellow, and I was very sad to hear recently from a talk show secondhand that sort of joking that she'd been through a divorce, that the kids are now interviewing prospective dates, and apparently the marriage didn't work out, and she had four children, and this fellow took over the TV business of the family. But I was very sad that it didn't work out. So I guess she's available for somebody, you know. I call her up. No, I'm not interested in that. But she was a very sweet, down-home Texas girl. So Monty, getting back, and I wish I had the exact messages. There were at least two, maybe three. I have them in a special book that Mother typed out for us, and we have them, you know, preserved and so on. But basically, they were to the effect that Baba was, we're so happy to hear of the work that Baba has for John in the White House. Something, and I, you know, I felt guilty. Here I am drinking a beer in the White House, you know. But that was just, you know, it wasn't like I was going crazy up in the White House, but I wondered, you know, what work am I doing? But, what? The date of, well, it was, it was following the summer of 64, and during that period, there were two messages at least, and another one was, and the opportunity that John gets to distribute Baba literature among top-ranking officials, which I did. So I guess there was some, you know, work that I was doing. But otherwise, I mean, how do you explain it? And I had no contact with politics after that, and I had no inclination. The karmic irony of it is that if anybody could have taken advantage of the situation, it would have been Charles. When Charles was growing up, we knew he was either going to become a terrific missionary or president of the United States. He was very interested in politics, and I think he has some charisma and still does. So Charles, I think, would have been better in this situation. But anyway, because of my athletic connection with the family, we'd ride horses and sort of going out with Lucy on the town. I don't know. Maybe it was supposed to be me. I don't know. But it was very interesting, and I always wondered about that. And I rarely tell students in my classes about it because people don't believe me or they think you're bragging.
Got the job in summer of 64.
Yeah.
That's when the message, Monty sent the message.
Yes, that's right. But I also had contact with her 2 years later in 66. So there were two real contacts there. And I feel very fortunate to have had that opportunity. One thing I didn't mention was after graduation, I hoped to get a job near the center, and that is wondering what Baba's work is going to be in the future. Mother told me something very beautiful, and I don't know how many tapes you have, probably not very many, but I want to tell a little bit about my relationship with Andy Boo as far as her death. And I found out recently that Mother told me that she said something to the effect of sitting on the porch looking out over Long Lake, that I can see that someday John will be doing a lot of work or some good work or something to that effect at the center. And I never knew that before, and it made me happy. And I hope that I will be. It may be 5 years from now. It may be 10 years from now. It may be 30 years from now. I don't. Yes. And I wanted to after graduation, but this job fell through. And then people keep saying, you know, why don't you move here? Because I'd stay there for weeks and help out, and I think fit in there pretty well. And I'd say, you know, I have this career and I have this nest, I have tenure, and I feel like I'm doing Baba's work. So I never felt the desire to, you know, be a member of the nearby community. I think partly because it's so special to me to go there. And I've heard this. When you live there, you don't get the charge that you get when you just go and you know you're going to come back. You take the ocean for granted, for example. To me, that's a spiritual experience. But I remember when, as far as Annie Boo, other little stories that come to mind, when David was born, we named him David, which means the beloved. But it was after Margaret's dead father, who died when she was a baby of cancer. But he was his middle name was David, and her last name was Emery. And it was nice to know that Auntie Boo said that her uncle was named David Emery. Spelled differently, but it was David Emery. So I sort of like that. And then, as I say, I got this job in the Shenandoah Valley, and it's just as if Baba sort of put me on the back burner for a while with all this ambition and all this drive. I'm in a peaceful Shenandoah Valley, and I've been very active on the national level in such ways as a national task force I chaired for 3 years on equal opportunity and human rights, which is Baba-type service, and had a chance to teach history of the Olympics and go to Montreal and Lake Placid and be with the top scholars, 2,000 of them in my field, and talk about Eastern thought. And I'm still trying to do papers in that area. And my ambition, if you can call it that, is to do papers on Baba's use of sports and his work, and also the Prem Ashram in that way. But I think it would be very interesting, and there is some attention being paid, of course, to inner tennis, Zen and the art of this, yoga concepts applied to sport and human movement. And I think the unique way that Baba used it, not just from an awareness and from a mystic standpoint, but just the way that he used sport and games to work with his disciples and his attitude towards sport. And I have some good quotes from Erich that have helped me in my work on that. And I like buying their quote on the game and the only game. And there were theologians at this scientific congress for physical activity that meets every 4 years, who talked about the divine game and God playing when he made the universe and the theology of play. So I think that would be fun to tie my love of Meher Baba in with my professional work. Okay. For the record, David, as I said earlier, I've never had an opportunity to do this sort of thing. And so in a way, it's very helpful to me to sort of look back and try and organize my feelings now that I'm in India and have something on tape that may be useful to you or may not be useful. But I think we are unique in that there were not that many young people around in 58. And Baba did call us his trio, and I do feel very blessed to have that relationship with him. At the same time, there's a tremendous responsibility that comes with that. And I think always being the oldest in the family, I think I was always the most serious. Mother always used to say, where's your pocket? Your smile, is it in your pocket? And I've always had that kind of thing. And here I am, you know, in this tape, taking myself so seriously. And in reality, you know, Baba's sense of humor always has helped me. And I think of Margaret Crask and her wittiness over the years, and Monty yesterday showing me the little animals off the table, the little pig and the little dog that turned over. You know, I need to learn that all this really is zero, and all this is nothing. What Baba really wants is for us to hold on tight to his Dhamma and not take things so seriously. And I'm trying to convey that through all this illnesses and through the professional success that I have had, making associate professor in my fourth year, I have tenure, I come up for full professor next year, and I'm not even just turned 35. And it's like the last little carrot they can hold in front of you in academe. And I've learned with each success that a little depression comes, that it didn't make me as happy, you know, as I thought. And so now I'm learning, I guess, to find Baba in my heart. And I had that question with Eretz, that to really please Baba, it's not so much achievements, but it's what he calls the way of effacement, which is so hard. It's removal more than I have this ski program or I'm doing that. And the provisional ego that Baba talks about is very hard. And we talk about burnout in my profession. And one woman said, we don't have a problem with burnout in my university with 50% of the staff. And someone said, well, why is that? And that's because they never were on fire to begin with. You can't burn out if you never were on fire. I think Baba has put us on fire, and we may burn out and we, you know, burn back on and catch fire again. I feel that in India, I am catching fire again, and I feel that's what we have available to us every moment, not just in India, not just in Myrtle Beach, but when we're quiet and when we call on him. And I do every night for at least 15 to 30 minutes. I'm alone with Bob and read something. I'm reading Kitty's book at an incredibly snail-like pace, a page or two, and all those memories come back. So I've learned by being quiet that you can experience him. And there's so many little things, I guess, that just come to mind. I know right before Andabu's death in August, before these strokes happened, I was pouring out some of the things and whether I should be remarried and, you know, what's going to happen as far as my personal life and trying to be a good father to David and professionally and so on. And it was a rare, quiet moment with her. And she had experienced some discomfort during the summer, was getting weaker and so on. It was late in the evening. She was in her bathrobe. And I've told this to a couple of people here, and it's been helpful. And I want to have it recorded. She was going back toward her bedroom, and I'd sort of given her a hug, and I didn't think I'd see her, you know, for a whole fall semester, which I wouldn't. And she saw, you know, all this tension that was in me and gave me a hug and tried to make me feel better. And she walked toward her room, which I think Mother said, you know, was the smallest in the house. You know, always had Andabu was so humble, always. But she's walking toward this small room. She turned around with her bathrobe on, and she said, you know, John, she said, at the end of the day, I think back to whether or not the most important thing had been accomplished that day that needed to have been done. And she said, if that's been accomplished, if I did that, then I don't worry. Gave me a little smile and just abruptly turned around and walked into her room. And that did so much for me because I am an overachiever. I am a very intense, worried type person. That's the irony of Baba, don't worry, be happy. I think if I didn't know Meher Baba, I'd probably be a basket case. I know I would be. And he puts things in perspective. And that really helped me because we have to put priorities on our work, on our friendships, on our family. And I think for many years, I did put my work ahead of my family. And it cost me a divorce, but as I say, I think that was inevitable. But there are ways that we can set priorities, and I think Andabu has that insight to offer anyone who would want to learn from that quote, because it's meant an awful lot to me, what she said. One of the things, I guess, that stands out in my memory about Andabu, of course, is that she's my link to Baba. And when Baba dropped the body, I transferred probably a lot of that personal closeness to her when I embraced her and so on and saw in her eyes Baba. And I know Baba gave me that because I didn't see it before. Of course, I was an adolescent and always worrying if I did the right thing. And, you know, I'd be noisy or this or that. And I remember even shooting a window out at a garage one time where we, you know, at our house with a BB gun, you know, just terrible thing. I'd gotten this new BB gun, decided to shoot out a couple of windows. And she was firm and stern with me and worked out a deal where I could pay for the windows. But still accepting of me, but not accepting of the behavior. And there were things like that she did to me all along. She understood the fact that I had trouble expressing my feelings, that Bible was a very private thing to me. She understood also that I was moody. I remember I had an acne problem for a while. I got it from my father in New York. She took me to a leading dermatologist on Park Avenue with my mother, and I got very shy about it and just, you know, was almost ready to cry. And she understood, and she just said, all right, you know, let's leave. And she never pushed the dermatology thing again. You know, all these little tender things that she did. I have a quote that she sent about, don't worry, be happy. And this was a time when I couldn't be with her at Christmas because of my son. And she said, we hope that you're going to be with us at Happy House soon, come soon. And that was not too long ago, before her death. And of course, I treasure these things. And as I look back, Baba had it all planned, because she always remembers my birthday with my mother. And October, after the first stroke, which was the 30th, before the second one, when it really got bad in November, I called her up because I had no card. I called the next day. And mother was so busy, you know, and she said, oh, you know, I thought your birthday was the 31st. I was going to call, this and that. So glad you called. And we had a nice conversation. And she said, your Auntie Boo got your pink carnations, and they've been so fresh for so long. She'd like to talk to you. I said, really? She's up to it. She said, yes. She's been back in the living room. So she got on the phone. And all I can say is she said all the things that I ever wanted her to say to me. And she reminded me of the anniversary time when I was with Baba on my birthday, and how she was called to get me at baseball practice. I mean, just went on and on her own accord on the phone, just giving me all this love. And she said something to me that I'll never forget, that she'd never said to me before. And it was in the context of bringing me to the center and, you know, going to India and so on. And she said, you're my little boy. And she'd never said that to me before. And, you know, I think it was implied that she sort of adopted the, you know, the Haynes kids, you know, as her own, because she didn't have any children. And, of course, we're very blessed that she did adopt us in a very real way. And I'm very much closer to her than I am, you know, any member of my family, including my mother, because of Baba. You know, and I love my mother very much, but she brought us to Baba. And now she's gone. And fortunately, I have a very close relationship with my mother. Who? Auntie Boo, her husband died, Kenneth died, but he understood for several years her need to go to India, and she was very successful, you know, in business, and they had a very good marriage, and she met Bob at Harmon on the Hudson, and she just said, I feel this need to go. And I talked to her nephew, Harry Hartshorne, this summer about that, and he said, you know, it was very hard on Kenneth, you know, he was almost you know, a widow in a sense, because she was gone with her work for Baba. But he said she understood, and he respected that. But he did die, and I'm not sure exactly of the date. It might be 57. You can find out about that. But I think, you know, she, in a sense, understood about my divorce, because in some ways, toward the end, they led separate lives, even though he loved her and he understood. It was basically that kind of relationship. So, but I'm not sure why, whether they couldn't have children or why they didn't or whatever. But, you know, they could have. I mean, theoretically, I'm not really sure the details of that. But I'm just very grateful for her love that she gave us. So she was always, Auntie Boo was always very protective, you see, of us, as far as us knowing about her being ill. And she had these B12 shots for many years, and Mother would take her on these trips, and we were so glad that she could go and Mother could escort her and people wouldn't know when she was ill. And it was the only place that she could rest was a ship, and nobody could reach her, you know, even by cable. It was a hassle. And she always, you know, encouraged us to travel, and she loved travel very much. And so in that context, I didn't feel that I should rush to the center after the first stroke, because I didn't want to draw attention to it. I didn't want her to make her feel bad or make her feel sicker than she was. So we all decided not to. But as I said, she gave me all this love, and I thought, well, things are going to be okay. And Baba gave her that time of going to the hospital and then coming back once again. And I'm sure you understand a little, don't you, about that, how she got to come home and get well and saw my flowers every day and just all this love she gave me. Well, when I heard it was bad, of course, I came immediately, and I drove all night, and I got there around 1:30 in the morning, and I took a chance. I went directly to the hospital, which ironically she helped build, because After my accident, she got the one built in Myrtle Beach through the Ladies League because she realized it wasn't one. And then this new one took care of her. So I just did some fast talking, and with Lava's help, told them I had medical training, was allowed to go into her room. And she had a private nurse, and no one was to go in, you see. Excuse me. And Mother would relieve the nurse, and we would go on shifts.